Okay, good afternoon, one and all. Let me thank my PhD student, Gargi Chowdhury, for lecturing on Monday. I just had lunch with Gargi. She is about to leave and take a postdoc in Anchorage, Alaska. It's pretty exciting. She just finished her PhD. So thank you, Gargi. Today we're going to keep going with the material she introduced. So what she covered, I hope, was a return to cartometry and looking at some of the other properties that we can measure when we've got information about features on maps. So we covered things like shape measurements and how we can quantify those. Today I want to go a little bit further. I'll finish the spatial measures that I want to introduce in the class and that are covered in the textbook. And then I'll go on to the next theme, which is then using some of those measures to actually do hypothesis testing about geographic phenomena. Okay, so today we're going to talk about applications of the measurements that we've introduced, the feature measurements. Okay, so this is a recap from the last lecture, or I hope it is. Gargi covered the material last or two. We looked at various ways of measuring shape. We were introduced to the Miller method. The Boyce-Clark method is discussed in the textbook. The Bungy method is not in a lot of detail, so Gargi should have covered that, I hope, on Monday. But these are methods of applying or producing quantitative values that characterize shapes. Many of them are based upon measuring the periphery of shapes. That's what we can capture as the coordinates and the outline of a shape, say the outline of a lake, for example. Bungy's method is somewhat different in that it produces not one but multiple methods that apply at different scales. So this is a new component, the idea that shape can change across scale, which it can, as we've seen in many times in cartography. I didn't cover the Fourier measures, and probably beyond the scope of this class, but there are indeed methods that apply, that take the X and Y series of a shape, treat it as a series, and then decompose that into its Fourier components. That's the sort of combinations of sine and cosine waves that make up the cycle of the shape in any given direction. And those can do quite a good job of representing the shape or quantifying the shape of an area. Then for distribution or measuring distribution, I hope Gargi introduced the idea of quadrat analysis. Quadrat analysis is very useful if you have a phenomenon that occurs at points. You can basically put down a grid over whatever it is you're interested in, and of course coordinate systems come with their own grids embedded in them. They're already increments of eastings and northings that can be used to sample the landscape quite conveniently. And quadrat analysis is a way of counting how many things occur in different quadrats, and then we can devise tests to see whether or not those distributions meet the conditions of random distribution among the quadrants. Today I want to introduce another measure of distribution that's a little easier to compile, and I'll compare it with the quadrat methods that you met in the last class. Okay. So let me introduce the value here, R, or something called the nearest neighbor statistic. I think it was hinted at in the last lecture. This is an abstract from a meeting in San Diego, a GIS meeting, in which the theme of what was being analyzed was some data from the 1980s, I believe, 78 to 81, for food poisoning cases in, that looks like Miami, yeah it is, down here in the tip of Florida. And in this case, these people had information about where people got this instance of food poisoning, and where they were located, and we're looking for causative factors, you know, what explains this distribution. So what they did, or part of their study, was to calculate with 304 index cases, of which 169 of them were in Dade County. Miami is pretty much coincident with Dade County in Florida. They calculated something here called the R value, and it came out 0.1. And they say this indicates a strong clustering pattern. So the nearest neighbor statistic is indeed used in research, very practical. It's rather easy to calculate, and it gives you a very quick and quite accurate measure for the degree of clustering of distributions. So how do we compare it to quadrat analysis, what we've already been introduced to as a way of looking at distributions? Well, unlike quadrat analysis, which if you remember that slide discussing the weaknesses of the method, the actual locations of the points are used as part of the calculation. So we're not going to throw away the point locations by simply counting which quadrat they fall into. So we're actually going to use the distances between points as its basis. And we can express it in words. I'll give you words rather than an equation. It's the mean of the distance observed between each point and its nearest neighbor. And that can be compared to the expected distance between points and the nearest neighbor given the area into which the points fall. We'll go over the calculation of it in just a second. And we can compare that to random occurrences, and we're going to do some comparisons against random in the next while. One of the advantages and problems of it is that it needs a reference area. In the previous study, we had a convenient reference area, which was Dade County, for which we'd chosen the data that fell into Dade County. So the reference area was given to us. In not all other instances is the reference area given to us. We'll discuss that in just a second. So just glancing at these three point patterns, which are the ones out of the textbook, by the way, everybody in the room would agree that these are clustered together. Probably everybody would agree that these points are pretty uniformly distributed across the area, and the first one lies somewhere in between. It's neither clustered nor uniform. So this one is pretty much at random. Random would probably have a little bit more clustering in it than that normally. Our expectation would be, because things do cluster at random. So we use these terms, these English language terms, random, uniform, and clustered. But what the nearest neighbor statistic is an effort to put a quantitative real value to do cartometry, a real value on this degree of clustering. Okay, so let's define a set of values for every one of those points. Let's start with one of those point distributions. And let's say start with this point right here. For every point, there is a point nearest to it that is closer than all the other points. So if we start this point here, for example, and keep going outwards, by the time we've reached the radius of this circle, we've reached its nearest neighbor, which is that point right there. So in each case here, I've linked each point to its nearest neighbor, and notice that nearest neighbors are often in pairs. So if A is nearest to B, then B is often nearest to A. So we get detached outliers like this. When we get a cluster forming, we begin to see points linked together like this. So we begin to see sort of networks appearing within the points. So for each point, we can define a nearest neighbor, and we call that the nearest neighbor point, and we can calculate the distance to the nearest neighbor distance, and we know exactly how to do that because we've done calculating distances from coordinates and so on. Notice that some of these distances are fairly short if points are close together, and some are a little bit longer as the points are a little bit more spaced out. It's the distribution of those lengths that is of interest here. Okay, so let's go over the actual calculation. Here's a little formula down here. I won't go over it in any length, but I'll point out that this is the sum of all the nearest neighbor distances on the top. And if we divide that by the number of points, what we're actually doing is dividing a distance by n, so we're giving it the sort of distance length associated with all of the points. And here we have the square root of the area of the number of points. Okay, the area of the number of points, that's like partitioning up the area, the geographic area, uniformly and dividing it up equally among the points. And then we take the square root of that, so we convert an area into a distance, because distance times a distance is an area. It's in square meters and not meters. And we take twice that, and notice that this is a ratio. Okay, let's actually go through that calculation in each of the instances. I've conveniently color-coded these distributions. So the yellow is random, the sort of pink-purple color is uniform, and the light blue is clustered. So let's go over each of those instances. Let's start with the random one over here. here's the 10 points that are in the distribution. This is the point value of the nearest neighbor. That's the, okay, so 9 is nearest to 10, and 10 is nearest to 9. That makes sense. That's a neighbor pair. And this is the distance of separating each of the points. So you notice that they go from 0.1, 2 points that are very close together here, to 1, and then up to 2.7, much larger value here. So if I take these values and add them together, I get the 10.9 here. And I can use that value to calculate the... here's the area of the region, 50 units. We calculate the density, 0.2. When we take that and make a ratio out of it, we end up with this particular value for R, 0.97 approximately. Very close to 1. Okay, so in this instance, we've calculated this value, and the nearest neighbor statistic comes out as a value pretty close to 1. Now let's take a look at this one. If you remember, this was a uniform distance. Well, the points are pretty much equally spaced, one to the next. Here's the points with their nearest neighbors. It's the same same point numbering system. In this case, the distance to every one of the nearest neighbors is exactly the same. It's 2.2 units. So they're almost perfectly uniformly arrayed, you might say. 10 times 2.2 is 22. So divided by the 10 gives us the 2.2. That's the expected, the measured nearest neighbor distance. The area is the same. The expected density is here. Here's the mean. And then we calculate the R. They're using a slightly different formula than mine here. So we come up with 1.96. That's pretty close to 2. And a value of 2 implies that we have a more even or uniform distribution of points. Let's do it for this instance here. If you remember, the point distribution for the third group is kind of clustered together, so you would expect the distances to be much smaller. And indeed they are. Every one of the distances is 0.1. They're all quite close together. We add that up, we come to 1, divide it by 10, we get 0.1 here. Area is still 50, the expected density is still the same. When we calculate R here, we end up with 0.089, or about 0.1, quite a small value. Okay, and that's the kind of the value we would expect if the points were close together. Let's assume a theoretical instance. Let's say that every point is directly on top of every other point. Then all the nearest neighbor distances are going to be 0. And we're going to end up with an R value of exactly 0 if the nearest neighbor distances are 0. Okay, relatively simple to compute. You usually don't have to compute it. There are nearest neighbor algorithms built into many computer programs for doing mapping, so you can calculate it using scripts and so on. Quite a nice handy thing to know. So why is this a better method than quadrant analysis? Well, it may or may not be a better method. It depends upon what you're trying to accomplish. So the first thing here is that we have no quadrant size problem to be concerned with. If you remember, one of the concerns with quadrant analysis was that how do you choose how many squares and how big do you make the squares? And the quadrant is an important consideration. This actually takes distances into account. So we've measured distances and use actual distances the way they occur in the field. This would take advantage if we knew the coordinates of the points. But it doesn't solve all of our problems. There are some new problems that it introduces. The first thing is we relate this to the size of the boundary. Now, the boundary may have actual meaning in the real world, like the outline of Dade County, Florida, but it may not. We may have to choose some area to constrain each of our points, and that's important how you actually go about choosing that area. I've got some data I'm analyzing right now on the from GPS data from African birds, hornbills, in Cameroon. And we're trying to look at the distribution of where these birds were in the environment and how that relates to the preserves that have been set aside to protect their breeding areas. And we're having to come up with ways of describing the distribution. This is one of the issues, is that we don't know what the boundaries are associated with them. How do you define what the ranges of their habitat are? It's quite complex. So you have to consider how to measure the boundary. So it can be some arbitrary boundary, such as, you know, the polygon that's formed by connecting all the outermost points together. But again, that's arbitrary. Or there might be some natural boundary that makes sense. So we let's say we've got a distribution. Let's look at the range of values. Here's a value that's very clustered, that's entirely within the area. There's a lot of empty space around it. And we use a nice unit square in this case to calculate the nearest neighbor statistic. And its value comes out where you'd expect it, kind of low. If we had a distribution that looked like this, neither clustered nor random, this is going to come out around 1. If we have points arrayed on a regular grid, almost perfectly arrayed, the value would become 2. The geometry is quite easy to calculate in that case, because we get the actual measured distance close to the average distance, expected distance. And if we then lay the points out on not a square grid, but on a sort of triangular grid, so that each point is equidistant from its 6 neighbors, doesn't matter which one you use to calculate the nearest distance, they're all the same, it has its theoretical maximum of about 2.14. Okay, but look at this boundary problem and how this comes into play. So let's take this distribution here, which here we've measured its nearest neighbor statistic as very clustered, and all we do here is close the units in around the outside of it, and recalculate its nearest neighbor statistic. Now it looks like it's random. So just by changing the area that we're using to calculate the nearest neighbor statistic, we can change the value. So that's really not ideal. So if we had some kind of arbitrary polygon like this, how would you determine whether that's clustered or random? Well, it could be either. It depends on the units that you're using for making the measurement. So here's the bottom line on the nearest neighbor statistic. It's a relatively easy to calculate and understand. It just uses the locations of the points and their nearest neighbors. But it's somewhat more complex to interpret, because we can't assign any statistical probability to it. We can't say that we're 95% certain that this is clustered, that there is no variance measure to associate with it. And it's very sensitive to this choice of what the area units are that we're going to use to make the measurement. Okay, clustering is a reality. We see it all over the place in geographic distributions. And often we're sort of, the eye is trained to look for clusters or unanticipated clusters. Often a clustering is against a background, and we only recognize it when we compensate for the background. So here, this is a map of the distributions of Lutherans as a percentage of all residents for the year 2000 in the United States. So we've taken the total proportion of the population for a particular religion. Shaded in red here are those counties which have more than 50% Lutherans. And you might think Lutheran, well, that's probably spread uniformly across the United States, but we very quickly see that there's a direct link between historical patterns of migration and where people live in this case, and their religion. So the Minnesota and the North and South Dakota account for almost all the concentration of Lutherans in the United States. We very quickly drop off as we go elsewhere within the country. So clustering, I would argue, is often going to be present in all sorts of geographical distributions. And having a number to measure clustering, to say that a value is clustered, actually has a great deal of sense to it, has a great deal of analytical sense. This is the mean number of overall unhealthy days, that's days off work sick, among adults by geographic area in the 1990s. So this is a distribution that, you might expect to be somewhat random, because the distribution of various things like colds and flus and so on is relatively random across the population. But when you begin to see clusters in anything health-related, you begin to have to wonder about what the causes are. And here we see a very distinct cluster crossing the border here between Kentucky and West Virginia. So we might begin to suspect that this is a geographic cluster, that there is some significance to it. And indeed, in much of the geographic work that's focused on identifying clusters and where they are, has worked on health data. So it's looked for things like unexplained clusters of the occurrence of a particular disease, like cancers or sometimes epidemic diseases, where you're looking to see perhaps where the origin point of a new disease is, so that you can go to the source and try and contain it better. Okay, so that's clustering. Let's move on to the next step and take the next logical step in cartometry and in measurement. And this is a sort of comparative step. Now we're not doing strict cartometry, which is measuring the distributions on the map. Here we're making the point, how does this map compare to that map? Well, how do I take one geographic distribution and relate it to another geographic distribution? And we'll start with the simplest way of doing this, and we'll look at a couple of other ways. So the generic question might be, does A relate geographically to B, where A and B are maps or geographic distributions? Now, what we need is an index or some kind of measure of the degree of spatial correspondence, so that if the two maps were identical, it would be like one, a perfect match, and if the two were completely opposite, independent of each other, it would be zero or unrelated. You can imagine also that we might have negative relations. So we might have one map that is the exact kind of opposite of the other map, that where something occurs on map A is where it doesn't occur on map B. Now that's a negative association. Okay, so we're going to look at three different measures that do this. The coefficient of area of correspondence, which uses set theory and intersections and unions. A chi-squared measure that uses quadrats, and another quadrat-based measure, Yule's Q. All three of these are covered in the textbook, and I'll give you the page references in the text where you can check this out on your own time later. Okay, so here's the problem. Here are two maps. This one is dated May 20th, 2002. This one is May 20th, 2003. They both have exactly the same legend, and the legend is showing soil moisture. It's an index of soil moisture. You can calculate these quite simply. They're just you basically take a sample of soil, and you bake it until it's perfectly dry, and then you weigh it. You compare the wet weight and the dry weight, and see what the ratio is. In other words, you can figure out how much water was contained within the soil. So basically, green means wet. We've got high levels of moisture. And we go through yellow, which is extremely low, to red, which is extremely dry. Now, this part of the world, Texas and Great Plains, Southern Great Plains states, have been undergoing successively, progressively worse droughts year after year for a very long time. As you probably realize, whether or not this is a permanent shift remains to be seen. It's one of those great unknowns of climate change. So here we have two maps separated by a year, and obviously they're slightly different. Are they significantly different from each other? Or would you expect this much variation normally year to year, so that you couldn't really say whether or not the change was significant? This one definitely looks like the drought is more severe and less severe. It's more constrained to West Texas and so on in this image. Okay, well, one thing we can do is overlay. You can take the two maps and put one on top of the other, and then if we have classes, and here we've got, one, two, three, four, five, six, seven classes. If we've got classes, we can count all the co-occurrences of the classes with each other. Okay, so here's one set of classes, here's another set of classes. If we overlay them, we can say that this lower left-hand part here that's in area C and 1 makes a new polygon that looks like this, that's the overlap zone between C and 1. And here's A and 1 and A and 3 and so on. So we end up with a larger set of polygons. Note that the map becomes a little bit more complex to draw because we have to add intersection points at all the overlays. So this concept of overlay is done very frequently in geographic information systems. It can be done by the software, and then we can do analysis. Notice that one of the nice convenient things about this is that these could be completely different sets of units. So let's say the top one here is population data from the census by census tracts, and that's all well and good, but it's not the units we want. We want health districts, let's say. These could be health districts, So this would allow me to sort of disassemble the data from one set of units and then re-aggregate it back up into another set of units. That's the most common cause for which we do overlay. So here's the example in the textbook. This is an example of calculating Yule's Q. And here we the process works like this. We take two maps, here's map A and here's map B. These happen to be precipitation and wheat. We make them binary. We make them have only two classes. So in this case, we've done that by saying that we only have an area of high precipitation and not high precipitation. Okay, so we've divided the distribution into two. We have to pick some arbitrary isohyet. That's a line joining points of equal wetness. And divide the map into two. And we've done the same thing here. In this case, this is wheat yield. So it would be the total amount of wheat that we can grow on the soil at that particular location, the amount that the farmer is able to grow and harvest and sell. And we ask ourselves the question, is the amount of wheat that we get directly related to how much moisture we have or how much rain we have? Okay, it's a reasonable question to ask. You know, the wheat is very water sensitive. We have all sorts of different grains of wheat and so on. But normally speaking, if you don't get rain, you ain't going to grow any wheat. Okay, so what do? Well, we overlay our quadrant. Here's the 28 squares that you probably saw in Monday's lecture. We draw them over the entire area. They're equally sized grid cells. And now each one of those cells belongs to one class in the first map and another class in the second map. And we've just simply, these are all shaded diagonally this way, these are all shaded diagonally that way. So cell number 9 is in the high precipitation zone, but not in the high wheat zone. Whereas cell 25 is in the high precipitation zone and also in the high wheat zone. Yeah, so now we've got a new map, and we have a set of 28 squares which fill in those four classes that represent the combination of the two classes map to map. So we've got low precipitation, high precipitation versus wheat versus high wheat versus low wheat. Okay, now we need to set up our test and how we're actually going to test to see whether or not there's some relationship between these two values. So here's the question we're going to pose. Is there a relationship between the distribution of rainfall and the wheat yield in the area shown? That's like our research question. Okay, we're going to convert our research question into a hypothesis. We say we're going to use a particular test. And we're going to set up a null hypothesis. That's kind of like the straw man that we want to knock down. The null hypothesis in this case, we say there's no relationship. Or we can't prove that there's any relationship present on the map. We set up an alternative that is there is a relationship. So if we can't reject this, then we have to accept the alternative as being true. So we set up a condition in which we can reject the null hypothesis. And for that, we're going to use a numerical value. This value is called chi-squared. You've probably met it in your career before, especially if you've taken any statistics classes. We're going to make the assumption that there is no relationship whatsoever between maps A and B. That's our null hypothesis. We're going to compute statistics that allow this assumption to be rejected. And we're going to use chi-square. Chi-square is a kind of a nice value. It's for every value that we actually have, an observed value, minus the value that we expect it to have, we can do a subtraction. That's the difference between what we got and what we expected. We square those because some are positive and some are negative. To get rid of the negative sign, we divide it by the expected values, and then we add that up for every one of the observations. In this case, we're going to have four observations. You'll see why in just a second. And then once we've calculated chi-square, we can check its actual value against a theoretical table of values that have measured it, the normalized value, against statistical distributions that allow us to see whether or not we can assign a confidence limit to the degree of strength of the relationship. Okay, so here we go. This is on the textbook, page 193. In this instance, you can go there and take a look at it, but trust me, I've copied it very carefully. I don't think I made any mistakes. So we set up a table. It's called a contingency table. So on this side, we have the occurrences of rainfall, and that can be either high or low. And across the top here, we have the occurrences of wheat yield, which can be either high or low. Okay? And we add totals columns to the bottom and to the right. Okay, so the total of the totals here is 28. So what we're counting is grid cells on the quadrat, right? So these numbers here represent the actual occurrences of the four classes that I mentioned. You know, high, low, high, low, low, high. Those are the four possible combinations. So we have 8 cells that are both in the high category for the rainfall and high for the wheat. We have 2 cells that are in the high for the rainfall and the low for the wheat. The 8 and the 2 total to 10. We have 5 cells that are in the low rainfall category but the high wheat yield. You notice that that's smaller than this one number. We have 13 cells that were in the low rainfall category and the low yield category. That totals to 18. 10 and 18 total to 28. Notice that we can total it this way as well. So these are our observed values. These are the values, numbers that we counted from the quadrat just by looking at the combinations. Okay, so we could, you know, for example, here's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. There's that same 13 that's in the low category, low. Okay, we're just counting the cells that fall into the different combinations in this instance. Okay, now we need to calculate the expected frequencies. Okay, so we throw away the numbers in the middle of the table here, and we're just going to work with these values at the edges. Okay, so follow my logic here. High yield, that's this entire column, is 10 cells out of 28. Okay, that's 35.7% of the occurrences are going to be high yield. And low yield is the opposite, it's 64.3%. So if we times the total high yield of 13, so here's the total high yield values. If we multiply that by our 35.7%, we get 5. Okay, so those are the values that I can calculate just using the totals, just using the aggregate values. I would expect that given that I have 13 cells in the high category and that 35.7% of them are going to be in that area, I multiply 13 by 35.7 and I get 5. So there's my expected entry for the field there. Okay, and I can do this for all four values in the quadrant. In each case, using the totals, the rows and the column totals and the aggregate total, and this allows me to calculate expected values for each one of the four cells. Okay, here's my expected values. It's 5 here, 5 here, 8 here, and 10 here. I put them in red in this particular one. So now I've got a 4x4 table, that's this part, in which I have the observed values and the expected values given the aggregate distribution. That's expected from these totals along here. That means I calculate chi-squared because I've got observeds and expecteds, and I've got 4 of them, so I need to sum them up. Okay, how do I do that? Well, I got 8 when I expected 5. Okay, 8 minus 5 is 3 here. Okay, square 3 and I get 9 because I'm going to square the differences, and I'm going to divide the 9 by 5. Okay, so there's the observed minus expected squared for that particular, observed minus expected squared divided by the expected for that particular cell is 9 over 5. For this one, it's also 9 over 5. It was negative 3 in this instance. This one was over by 3. This one was under by 3. That's what you'd expect along a row. This one was 5 minus 8. That's under by 3. So I square the 3, get 9, in this case my expected value is 8, so my contribution to chi-squared is 9 over 8, and in this one I get 9 over 10. Okay, so to actually calculate my chi-squared, I need to just add all these red numbers up. So let's do that. Remember, chi-squared is the observed value minus the expected value squared, divided by the expected value and then summed across all the instances. So for the example I just showed you, it's 9 over 5 plus 9 over 5 plus 9 over 8 plus 9 over 10, which is 1.8 plus 1.8. Well, you get it. It comes out to 5.625. Okay, that's my value of chi squared for this particular distribution. So what we're going to do is take that number and compare it against a theoretical distribution to see what the likelihood is that we could have gotten this number by chance. Okay, and again, we want the number to be provable beyond any doubt that that we didn't get the number by chance. So here's the chi-squared tables. They're actually in the back of the textbook, I think, if you want to take a look. Or you can just look them up on the web. They're pretty much ubiquitous. And if you see the way they're structured, first of all, we've got a number down here. That's called the number of degrees of freedom. Well, in our particular instance, we've got four observations. So the number of degrees of freedom that we use is 1 minus the number of observations, which we had 4, so the answer is 3. And the degrees of freedom is 3. So we go to this column right here. And then you'll notice up here we've got a value that decreases. It starts very close to 1, and then it gets less and less and less. Here it's 0.9. So that's the number, that's the value of chi squared that I would have to be able to say that the distribution was drawn at random. So if I had a value of 0.58, I could be 90% confident that my value was not the result of a random fluke. A value of 0.1 here, if 0.9 would be 10% confident. If I'm going to be 90% confident here, I need a value of 6.251. And then here's the 5%, and smaller proportions is the 1% level of confidence here. Okay. Now, if you remember my value, it was 5.625. Okay. So I asked myself the question, is 5.625 bigger than 6.251? And the answer is clearly no. Okay. So I cannot prove that there's a relationship between those two distributions. I cannot reject the null hypothesis that there is no relationship between the two distributions. Okay, so the higher the value that I get, the stronger the relationship. If I can reject it at very high levels of confidence, then I can be more and more sure that I've discovered a relationship between two variables. Okay, if this is completely new to you, that may not have been so easy to follow. I would recommend that you work through that chapter in the textbook and read it through yourself in your own time. Okay, so our conclusion here, using chi-squared as a way of testing a relationship, it's not possible to reject the null hypothesis. There is no relationship between wheat yield and high precipitation. That's what I'd have to write in my conclusion. This is getting what's often called a null result. You don't have an answer to your question. You can't definitively say anything. So our statistical test has failed, but kind of only just. I mean, we did have 5.6 and it almost, it's bigger than, say, 1 or 2. There is some indication that there might be some kind of relationship there. So what do we do? Well, let's use another different method to look for the relationship. We'll see if we can find it some other way. I would argue the most convincing way is simply look at it and see whether or not it looks the same. Use the eyeball reasoning. Okay, and in the textbook, the example they give is to use something called Yule's Q. So what the Yule's Q works like this. We divide the world up into high and low, or two classes for two distributions. We're going to overlay the two maps, and that'll give you four classes. That's the combination of two by two, exactly what we did with the precipitation and the yield map. And then we count quadrants in the four classes on the two by two table. That's exactly what we did before. And if we have four cells in the table, that's, if you remember, here's our contingency, our table like this. These are the four active cells. Okay, if we label those A, B, C, D, here they are labeled A, B, C, D. So we use the observed values only. We don't calculate the expected values in this case. We don't need to calculate the expecteds, which was probably the hardest thing to understand. Then Yule's Q is simply an index It's A times D minus B times C over A times D plus B plus C. Anybody that's done any matrix algebra knows that that's a determinant of the matrix. This is going to give us a value that lies between negative 1 and positive 1. So it's going to tell us not just whether there's a relationship, it'll give us some strength some measure of the direction of the relationship, whether it's positive or negative, which clearly we couldn't get from chi-squared because it was squaring those differences. Negative 1 is going to be a perfect inverse relationship. In other words, the maps are directly complements of each other. And positive 1 is a positive, perfect positive relationship. Okay, so here's our our observed table again. This is the first one that I came up with, where we just simply counted the quadrats that fell into the combinations of the four different classes. High-high, high-low, low-high, low-low. There's our 8, a 2, a 5, and a 13, and we just label them A, B, C, D, like that, to calculate Yule's Q. So we're going to calculate now AD minus BC over AD plus BC, which gives us 8 times 13 minus 2 times 5 over 8 times 13 plus 2 times 5. And if we do this, we get 94 over 114, which gives us a value of 0.82. Now, 0.82 is relatively close to 1. If it was 1, there'd be a perfect relationship between the two distributions. So if we have a value of 0.82, we can say that we can strongly hint at the fact that there is a relationship here of some kind. What we can't do with this is, and that it is a positive relationship, so we can sort of reject the hypothesis that there's an inverse relationship, the wheat likes dry soil. Unfortunately, there's no way with Yule's Q to calculate a level of confidence to go along with it. So we can't say that we're 99% certain or 80% certain or 95% certain of this fact. We can only simply say that we suspect that this is the case. Okay, so testing relationships. Well, there's millions of spatial relationships that can be tested, and geographers worry about this all the time and devised all sorts of methods for testing spatial relationships. These might be some of the research questions that you could approach with these sorts of methods. So you might say, is there a relationship between geographical location and the price of gas? That's not so hard to do. You don't have to start driving around. There are lots of websites that show you the price of gas in a community. You could just take that map and put it down and see whether or not the price of gas is randomly located or whether there's some actual trend in the price of gas. I would argue that there are trends in the price of gas that are directly related to how far you are from a freeway. You just get off 101 and see the first gas price you see versus the last gas price you see as you reach your remote location. It's usually much higher in price right by the freeway. And then, of course, there are global differences in the price of gas. So California gas prices are some of the highest in the country. You go out, say, to the Midwest or to the South, the price is going to be much lower because the gas companies use regional pricing. Yes, they actually do. They're in cahoots to try and maximize their profits. What a surprise, huh? Okay, here's another one that's more relevant to you as students. You say, are apartment rents less as the distance from the campus increases? So are we directly trading the inconvenience of getting to campus, say having to ride a bike or own a car, for price? Are the cheapest apartments, the most remote ones in the distant parts of Goleta or Santa Barbara, and the most expensive ones on DP in Isla Vista, does that relationship hold up geographically? Okay, we could easily do that. In fact, we have a student-created database for rental prices in Isla Vista. There's an online database. So it'll give you all those prices. And you could easily sample that, let's say do quadrat analysis to determine whether or not there's a spatial relationship. One that's been analyzed many times by geographers is this one. Do you pay more in areas where the average income is lower? The argument is that as you become more affluent, you can afford to move around and go to the cheapest store and buy your groceries at low prices. But if you don't have access to transportation, you end up having to buy from the corner store, which has the highest prices. So if we can map income and compare this to grocery store prices, you could do this. A former student of mine is working on what are called food deserts, areas that you literally can't find food of a particular type, like organic food, let's say, or healthy food, simply because of this relationship here. So it's been proven to exist. Here's an important one: increased cancer death rates in a district caused by water contamination. Okay, so if you had two maps, one of cancer rates and one of some, let's say, test results from water, can you prove a spatial relationship between those two distributions? If you can, it kind of implies that the water is a causative factor, and that you might want to do something about that. And here's one: is there a relationship between hydrocarbon emissions and decreased upper atmosphere ozone in the polar regions? If you prove that one convincingly, you can probably win yourself a Nobel Prize. Okay, so here's today's lecture. Summary: we've been looking at sort of, cartometry on steroids, tests of actual distributions or measurements that describe distributions. And now we're using those measures to compare distributions. And so we're comparing maps, basically. I've argued that distributions can be quantified, and there are lots of ways we can do that. We've looked at quadrat analysis. We've looked at some of the other techniques. Today I introduced nearest neighbor statistic. But there are hundreds of other ways of measuring and quantifying geographic distributions. We can compare maps, so we can test for spatial relationships, in lots of different ways. But we've looked in particular at two, chi-squared, and how that's calculated, the observed values compared to the expected values, to which we can actually apply statistical tests of confidence, and Yule's Q, which is much simpler, it's quicker and dirtier, it only uses the observed values, but it still gives us some level of confidence that we've discovered a spatial relationship. And by doing this kind of cartometry, we can do cartometry at higher orders. So we can test things like entire properties of maps, like shape, geographic distributions, spatial arrangements, and patterns. And that means that we can answer questions using these numbers about the environment as a whole, or the Earth as a whole. Okay, that's all I've got for today. See you all on Friday.